forms of stem cell research I see today, just as I saw in 2001, great, great promise to heal. Whether it's diabetes or Parkinson's disease or spinal cord injuries, stem cells offer hope for treatment that other lines of research simply cannot offer.
That was Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist last Friday on the Senate floor explaining his position on embryonic stem cell research and why he is backing more federal funding for embryonic stem cell research, asking the president to modify his policy. We're going to be talking about that with Amy White here on Issues Etc. for the first 20 minutes of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. After our conversation with Amy White, we're going to spend a little time with Molly Ziegler of Higher Things magazine talking about contemporary Christian music. That'll round off the first hour of the program. Then we've got 2 hour-long conversations that are of some real great significance. First, Dr. Reed Lessing will join us here in Studio A. Our ongoing conversation here during the summer, Christ in the Old Testament, continues as we talk about Christ in the book of Ezekiel. Dr. Reed Lessing of Concordia Seminary will be here for the second hour of the program. Then we're going to spend the last hour with Jennifer Roback Morse of the Hoover Institute. She has written a book called Smart Sex, How to Finding Lifelong Love in a Hookup World. Now, she has recently written much about the laissez-faire family. She is turning her eye upon the sexual revolution. The book is magnificent. We'll be talking to her about what she calls consumer sex and the cost to the consumer of consumer sex, where the sexual revolution is today, with Jennifer Roback Morse in the last hour of Issues Etc. Now, you saw this yesterday and the day before in the headlines. Here it is today again in the world section of today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Sudanese Arabs clash with backers of ex-rebel. There are pictures there that show the damage done by the riots that continue to take place in Khartoum, that country's capital. This is the time to act now. This is when things are really, well, they've been bad before, but they're getting bad again in this African country. LCMS World Relief attaches its relief efforts there in the Sudan. Very practical kind of things like food and building materials and gardening materials and help for people, for children, for families who have been dislodged from their homes by religious persecution and just general social upheaval. They attach it to Christ-centered, cross-focused relief efforts. That means they attach it to the preaching of Christ and Him crucified for sinners and local congregations. Time is of the essence. Unlike many relief organizations, LCMS World Relief is concerned about both body and soul. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, and you will find the LCMS World Relief logo there. Don't let the headlines pass you by tonight. Go to our website and find out how you can help as well through LCMS World Relief or contact them here in St. Louis. Area code 314-996-1683. 314-996-1683. They are open for the next 90 minutes to take your donation. As you read about this in the headlines, let's do something about it through LCMS World Relief. 314-996-1683. Amy White is our first guest. She's a regular here on the program, corporate and political speechwriter, author of a column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled Frist's Own Words, Defeat His Position. Amy, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Todd.
Well, what kind of response have you been getting to your column so far?
Well, I think the response I've received so far today has been very consistent with Gallup polls and different kinds of research that show that about 70% of Americans are in support of embryonic stem cell research. And most of my emails have been fairly angry responses about how can you have a problem with this and people are suffering. But my favorite one so far today was sent to the editor of the Post-Dispatch suggesting that rabid pro-life women like myself, and specifically myself, should be impregnated with all the leftover embryos from fertility treatments.
Well, that's a compassionate way of approaching the whole
thing. Well, I mean, you know, at least it had a creative approach.
Okay. I think probably what got under people's skin the most is that you start your column by saying that Senator Frist, in his argument for further federal funding of embryonic stem cell research, actually concedes what the debate is really all about and makes the case against embryonic stem cell research.
He did, and I don't know what exactly was in Dr. Frist's mind as he prepared this speech, but this was a very political speech. that was offered by someone who's the only medical doctor serving in Congress. He has advised President Bush on medical issues, including stem cell research. He's a presidential hopeful for 2008, and he has a pristine pro-life voting record. And when he took to the floor of the Senate last week to announce this fairly radical support for the stem cell legislation, there was no pro-life group, there was no lobbyist, there was no organization that he's worked with in the past that knew it was coming or had received any information that he was considering supporting this legislation. So from a political perspective, it was a blindside to most of the pro-life community.
Now, should it have come as a surprise? Because I watched the entire address, and it was lengthy. We're talking about 45 minutes all said with response on the Senate floor last week. And I think he began almost every paragraph with, as I clearly stated 4 years ago when he laid out his 10 principles or 10 talking points for embryonic stem cell research. Was this really a shift in his position in any real way, or has it simply come full flower?
I don't believe it's a shift. I agree with you on that, but I think that the emphasis on where I was 4 years ago was really a political statement. He is trying to emphasize that he has not jumped ship. He's trying to make the case, hey, I was here 4 years ago, and I'm in the same place today, and in the meantime, I've worked on a lot of pro-life issues, but on this issue, I am prepared to support federal funding of this kind of research. So I agree with you that it's not necessarily a change of heart, but he had conceded to President Bush's leadership on this issue that there would not be new federal funding for new embryonic stem cell lines. And so in that way, he did depart from the position he adopted in 2001 in support of the president.
Well, so before we go on to talk about a further critique of Frist's address to the Senate, do you think his admission here, his departure from the president on policy, if not in philosophy, will really represent a change in what's going to happen with embryonic stem cell research?
Well, I am concerned about it because there are indications, if you keep your ear to the ground on these kinds of issues, that there's some pro-life legislators, and some of them are from Missouri, who are facing increasing pressure from both the biotechnology industry and also from parents and relatives of sick individuals, but primarily sick children, really pushing these gentlemen very, very hard to support this research. We have an entire group of people who are either parents of ill children or relatives of ill family members who have been sold a bill of goods that if only the federal government would cough up a couple of million or $1 billion to support embryonic stem cell research, there would be a cure for the juvenile diabetes that their son has. There would be a cure for different genetic diseases. I mean, it has absolutely very little grounding in reality since these adults, embryonic stem cells have not yet produced a single applicable cure. But you have some very intense lobbying going on in D.C. And I think that Senator Frist, by going public once again with how he sees the issue and setting out what he calls an ethical and moral framework, he was potentially giving a roadmap for other conservative politicians to follow who want to be able to straddle this divide between being anti-abortion but pro-embryonic stem cell research.
Well, Amy, they certainly have enough political cover already. If it is true, as you said just a moment ago, that 75% of the population are in favor of embryonic stem cell research, they're pretty safe.
Well, the only reason why they're not totally safe is that those 75% who answer the phone and say, yeah, I'm in support of it, don't really know that much about it. And, of course, a lot of the research has shown that if you change the language that you're asking about embryonic stem cell research, you'll get a different response. So the public might have an opinion on it, but they're not very well educated. And the 75% who support embryonic stem cell research, I don't know what part of that constituency is going to get up on election day every 2 or 4 years and get to the polls to make sure they vote for their guys. Unlike the pro-life community, who has really staked their claim that they turn out the numbers in support of those politicians they believe are on the side of life.
All right. Back to that 75% number one more time. If 75% of the American population, either in ignorance or knowingly, are in favor of embryonic stem cell research, that means either in ignorance or knowingly, a fair number of pro-lifers are in favor of embryonic stem cell research. Do you think they see what has happened here with Senator Frist?
Well, I've heard from several people today who are in support of Senator Frist and think he was very courageous to say that we are both pro-life and pro-embryonic stem cell research. But when you look at the actual text of what Senator Frist delivered on the Senate floor, he went ahead and made the case out of his own mouth for how this can never be moral or ethical to conduct this stem cell research on embryos.
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're talking about Senator Frist's position on stem cell research with Amy White, who has authored a column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled Frist's Own Words Defeat His Position. Kurt is calling from his car. Kurt, welcome.
Yes, my question is, do you know where the Germans are on this issue? And they are much more sensitive to these issues because they've been through all the Nazi abuses and the experimentation on people during the Nazi era. And so the Germans tend to be much more thoughtful and informed on the scientific facts of these sorts of issues. And unfortunately, the American citizenry is not knowledgeable. They're being essentially marketed by, who was the gentleman, Reeves, who recently died, actors and actresses and others that are really not informing the citizens.
Kurt, thank you for the call. What do you know, Amy?
I don't know about what the German response has been to embryonic stem cell research, but I think the caller had an excellent point that the German community has already looked into the face of the abyss on this, about medical experimentation on fellow human beings for the benefit of the greater good, quote-unquote. And I do think they're more so sensitive and educated on the issues, but I don't know exactly where they are on this.
I found a glaring kind of contradiction in what he had to say when he was talking, and he was speaking there kind of in his physician mantle about how these cells have the ability to replicate endlessly, infinitely. And then he went on to say, oh, but by the way, the stem cell lines that we were using from before, from August 2000, they're useless to us now.
And, you know, I noticed that same thing, Tom. One of the things that he puts out there is how wonderful these cells are because they renew and replicate themselves over and over indefinitely. And just a paragraph below that, he says it was widely believed we had 78 embryonic stem cell lines when President Bush announced his policy. Now we find out we only have 22. Because the lines are unexpectedly starting to become less stable, less replicative, and they're acquiring and losing chromosomes and losing growth control. Now, that is the more sophisticated terminology to say they're creating genetic diseases by adding and deleting chromosomes, and they're growing tumors. That is the nature of growth control. Losing growth control of a cell is the kind of rapid growth that a tumor and cancer represents.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Roland is calling from his car. Hi, Roland.
Hi, guys. Maybe kind of a dumb question, but to follow on, as I'm trying to think this out, you know, in a linear way, it's great to talk about research now when you may be somehow possibly, but let's assume for argument that stem cell research brings cures with the base of that cure being a stem cell in some form, to all kinds of diseases. It's the panacea that we've all been looking for human disease. Where do these people think we're going to get enough of a supply of stem cells to continue the curatives that are going to treat these diseases? What, you know, where is it going to take us? Are we not, in sort of a circular way, saying, well, if we do cure all the diseases with stem cells, don't we have to then start propagating more abortions to keep the supply of the stem cells there?
That's a good question, Roland. Amy, how would you respond?
Well, Roland, I don't understand the science in enough detail to know if actual stem cells would be required for the stem cell treatments that would come out of the research. But I think it's a pretty good guess that if this research would, after 30 years, suddenly start to produce some kind of promising results, there is going to be an unbelievable market greater than there is right now for human eggs. And, you know, the issue with embryonic stem cell research is that they now have the technology to use a human egg and insert a skin cell from another human being to create an embryo. And that embryo is a clone of the person who donated the skin cell. So you're right that we are potentially looking at a situation where if this is what it's promised to be, and unfortunately there's no proof of that yet, we are potentially looking at the 1984 scenario that Orwell envisioned of the embryonic hatchery, where we have children being, you know, matched up in embryos, you know, in farm-type settings for the purposes of research. Now, the proponents of this research say, oh, you're so inflammatory and so dramatic and so over the top, and that would never happen because we're going to have careful governmental controls. Well, we've all seen government controls fail in many regards through most of our generation. So I don't think it's excessive or dramatic, and I think it's appropriate to at least think through, as you say, okay, if it does produce all these cures, what does that really mean?
By the way, Roland, if you go back a couple days, last week we were talking with Leslie Smith, and he gave essentially the same answer there as Amy, saying that really the argument that's taking place with regard to Frist is an old argument. The researchers are not talking about using IVF embryos, which is what Frist was trying to talk about, but in fact about human cloning, as Amy mentioned there. But as Wesley points out many places in his writings, even then with human cloning as a source for these embryonic stem cells, the numbers are impossible, absolutely impossible. They're mind-boggling how many human eggs you would need and how many human beings you would need to donate those eggs just to cure people, say, with one disease, namely adult-onset diabetes or something like that. What did you make of Frist's refrain, strict moral, ethical, and regulatory boundaries? What did you make of that?
Well, I thought that that was a very convenient way of saying, you know, we'll be very, very careful when we do this immoral and unethical thing to make sure we do it in the most ethical and moral means possible. I mean, it's doublespeak. In fact, Frist, as part of his remarks, talked about there are, in his own words, exciting new technologies that might enable us to create a stem cell without having to sacrifice an embryo. And by the words of his own mouth, he said, wouldn't we want to pursue this research by the most ethical and moral means? Well, of course we do. But of course he goes on to conclude that we will take the less ethical and less moral means, and in the meantime, go ahead and destroy embryos to access the stem cells.
Were there any other instances where Senator Frist contradicted his own argument as he was arguing for, inadvertently arguing against, on the basis of ethics?
Well, I think that he made some smart observations about the current bill that did pass through the House, the Stem Cell Funding Enhancement Act, and some of his reservations by his own, you know, his quotes are that it lacked a strong ethical and scientific oversight mechanism. He talked about it didn't prohibit financial incentives between scientists and fertility clinics that could make available these embryos or discarded fetuses for this work, and that it never specified whether it was the patients or clinic staff or who would have the final say about an embryo's future, whether it would go on to be available, to be implanted in someone's womb, discarded, made available for stem cells. All those were reservations that he brought out that he had about the act, the legislation is written. Then, amazingly, he goes on to conclude that with these reservations, I'm supporting the Stem Cell Research Enhancement Act, which I think really defies the idea that these are really serious concerns he's holding. If these are serious concerns, as he says, they need to be addressed before he would ever pledge his public support for the legislation.
He also seemed to hide behind this term parental consent, where he was talking about IVF embryos, in two ways. Number one, it gives the picture that everybody knows what's going on. Everyone signing their names on the dotted line have a clear idea of what's going on. And it seemed to assume, and I think a big assumption to make, that parental consent kind of solves an ethical dilemma about what do we do with so-called extra embryos.
Well, that's true, but Frist himself has an ethical dilemma with a woman's right to an abortion, because he believes that the embryo that's present in her uterus from the earliest stage is alive and human and biologically distinct. So if he has an ethical problem with the right to abortion, I don't know why he has no ethical problem with parents in a similar role opting to destroy the product of their sperm and egg.
So in summary here, your observation about Frist's comments from the Senate floor is that in many cases he actually makes the case against embryonic stem cell research, the facts that he cites,
well,
and that he contradicts himself.
He begins by making a strong statement for why the embryo is alive. Then he goes on to acknowledge that stem cell research on embryos is only possible if the embryo is destroyed. You know, there's no other means about that. He goes on to say that there are problems with the existing stem cell lines and there's no reason to conclude the same problems would not exist as this research goes on, no matter how fresh the supply is. And so out of the words of his own mouth, he's confessing all the ethical and moral issues that make this the wrong choice, especially in light of this bill's proposal to use federal funds to support this. We have gone through an exhausting process of determining that there might be a legal right to abortion, but there will not be federal funds for it because of the strong division that there is about the nature of life in the womb. And now he proposes that that debate is moot on this issue of embryonic stem cell research. It really comes back to the same philosophy. Do you believe that the product of the womb is alive or dead?
He used this term, nascent human life, and I thought when I heard it, why didn't he just say human life?
Well, because he's trying to make his case. So by adding the word nascent, he's saying, yes, it's human, but wow, it's nascent. You know, and when you look up the definition of nascent, it means the very earliest form.
Yes.
But he does go, he did say in his very own text, though, that the embryo was worthy of respect and dignity, and that we all, too, were embryos at the beginning of our life. And so after saying that the embryo deserves both respect and dignity, he concludes that somehow it's very dignified for the embryo to be sacrificed with no ability to give consent for the elusive promise that others might be cured through their sacrifice.
Finally then, Amy, Senator Frist is considered to be one among many potential presidential candidates for 2008. Was this a good move or a bad move politically on his part?
Well, I am absolutely confident that Dr. Frist believes it was a good move, or I don't think he would have made it.
Why did he do it?
I really, you know what? That's one of those gambles, and Richard Gephardt, Todd, took the same gamble. He held his finger up in the air, and he described it as a change of heart, when really I think that he embraced something that perhaps he did not really believe for the sake of his own political ambition. And I think that that went on to really deny him the high office that he sought his entire life of the presidency. So it will be interesting to see if Dr. Frist finds himself inheriting that Gephardt mantle.
So is your conclusion that this is much driven by political calculation?
Well, I believe the timing is very specific. You know, we're a year into President Bush's second term. We've got this Stem Cell Enhancement Act on the table. We've got midterm elections coming up. And I do think that Dr. Frist would not be a good politician if he was not looking ahead to what he wants to achieve. And looking ahead, he has determined that this would be a good political move. I certainly don't think that he's prepared to sacrifice himself politically on the altar of embryonic cell research. So I have to conclude that he believes it strengthens him politically, and only time will tell whether or not it truly does.
Folks, you can read Amy White's column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch. It's called Frist's Own Words Defeat His Argument, and they're at the web, stltoday.com, stltoday.com. Amy White, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
Amy White is a political and corporate speechwriter and author of that column, Frist's Own Words Defeat His Position. STLtoday.com is the website for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and you can find it there for yourself. Now, when we come back, Molly Ziegler will join us to talk about contemporary Christian music. We'll hear what she has to say, kind of a general overview of the entire industry. Dr. Reed Lessing will be our guest in the second hour of the program. Christ in Ezekiel will be the subject as he joins us here in Studio A. And then in the third hour, Jennifer Roback Morris will join us to talk about consumer sex and the sexual revolution today.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Civil religion is the use of religious ideas and terminology and even ritual in the service of the state. Is American civil religion necessary for our society? Why do so few Christians seem to be able to distinguish between the God of Christianity and the God of American civil religion? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for August is called The Anonymous God, The Church Confronts Civil Religion and American Society. You can find this book at two CPH bookstore locations in St. Louis, one at 3558 South Jefferson in the city, the other on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. Follow the signs to the CPH bookstore and ask for the Issues, Etc. book of the month for August, The Anonymous God. Those two locations, 3558 South Jefferson in the city, or on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. When you stop by, mention Issues Etc.
Visiting people where they live is a way for Christians to build relationships in India. This Global Minute focuses prayer on patiently sharing Christ with Hindus in their homes. Visiting in a home, listening to the questions and concerns of families, is one way evangelists in India build rapport so they can share Christ. Church planting is a major activity for India Evangelical Mission. IEM's evangelists also operate reading rooms where interested people can easily stop in and read a Bible or a book that a respected Christian author has written on a subject. Pray for evangelists with India Evangelical Mission to have wisdom. Many of them work in areas where large numbers of people live, but almost no one has heard of Jesus Christ. Get involved with India through prayer. Get a free brochure called To India with Love. Call 1-800-268-0461. 1-800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks. When she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. Today's the anniversary of Lizzie Borden doing in Andrew and Abby Borden in 1892 in Fall River, Massachusetts. Or was it Lizzie? She was brought to trial and acquitted. Whatever happened back then, kids today still have their moments with Dad and Mom, and sometimes for good reasons. The commandment says, honor your father and your mother. Martin Luther commented on that. Young people, he said, must be taught to revere their parents as God's representatives, and to remember that however lowly, poor, feeble, and eccentric they may be, they are their own father and mother given them by God. The test of the genuineness of faith is not intellectual assent to heavenly ideals, but practicing those ideals with less than perfect people. As kids in grade school, we used to sing this ditty, and we sang it out of any adult's hearing. I love Bosco, it's rich in poison D. Mommy put it in my milk and tried to poison me, but I fooled Mommy and put it in her tea, and now there is no Mommy to try and poison me. I'm sorry, Mom. That was very wrong on our part. Thanks for listening. I'm an apologetic Dale Meyer.
Dining with Sinners. That's what happens every Sunday at Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. The Lord Jesus himself comes and spreads his banquet table before us, sinners, not a target group of professionals, but sinners in need of the one thing that only he can give, the forgiveness that he won for us at the cross. Christian, seeker, unbeliever, it doesn't matter. All those who are burdened by their sin and hungry for God's forgiveness are invited to visit Bethany Lutheran Church, 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Coming up here in about 25 minutes, we're going to continue our summer-long conversation on Christ in the Old Testament. Christ in Ezekiel will be the subject as Dr. Reed Lessing joins us here in Studio A. Molly Ziegler is our guest in the meantime. We're going to be talking about contemporary Christian music. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Well, there's no doubt about it. It's now big money. Contemporary Christian music. It is now a legitimate piece of the pie, a full, rather large piece of the pie when it comes to the music industry and the billions, and we are talking about billions that are brought in, a fair number of those billions, sales of contemporary Christian music. You can find it now where you used to have to go to the Christian bookstore and look at a little rack of tapes and albums and go through a few artists. Now there are hundreds and thousands, and now you don't have to go to the Christian bookstore, just go to the mall. And they have a whole section there on it as well. So how is it musically? We'll be answering that question here in this 25 minutes. Molly Ziegler is a freelance writer in Washington, D.C., author of an article in the latest Higher Things magazine titled Contemporary Christian Music, Majestic or Merely Mediocre? Molly, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you for having me back, Todd.
Molly, I know you're also working on a book project. What's it about and how's it coming?
I'm looking at the interfaith movement that's spreading throughout America, how religions are being blended together and forced down our kids' throats in schools across the country and in our public festivals. And we have interfaith worship services left and right now, and I'm looking at what the impact of that is on Christians.
So what have you learned so far in your research for the book?
I've learned that the one thing that I didn't quite understand as much as I do now when I started this project is that there's a difference between the church and the government, and that distinction needs to be upheld. And too often people confuse what the role of the church is with the role of the government, and they look to their politicians for spiritual guidance where they should be looking to their pastors.
Folks, by the way, since Molly mentions the nexus between the two, Sunday night on the program, we're going to be discussing that very subject, among other things, with Dr. Ken Sherbin, Dr. David Adams. American Civil Religion will be the subject Sunday night on Issues, Etc. from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Molly, as you peruse the market and the broad spectrum of music that's being put out under Christian labels as contemporary Christian music, how do you assess it musically?
Well, to some extent, musical tastes are just that, a matter of taste, and some people prefer classical over hip-hop or rock and roll over R&B. And knowing that there are different tastes, it's still true that some songs are better than others and some bands are more skilled than others, and it doesn't really take a PhD in music theory to know, for instance, that the Beatles are much better than Britney Spears. And similarly, you don't have to be a musical expert to know that much of what happens in contemporary Christian music is boring and lifeless compared to its secular counterparts.
Well, here's an example that I have come across. I'm a country music fan, so there's no accounting for taste. Please forgive me for that. But I was just the other night, I don't know, my wife was watching it, and we were watching one of our favorite groups, Rascal Flatts, sing, and these people are just hands down so talented that you almost nearly fall over every time they sing and play. And it's raw talent at work here. And I was thinking to myself, you know, it is amazing the quality of music that you can find, the variety of the quality of music that you can find in something like country. Is the same true of contemporary Christian music? Some really, truly, unbelievably talented musicians who are given a bad name by kind of the rest of them?
Well, I would say that there are a couple of bands that are either Christian or have Christian members that are making some amazing music. Starflyer 59, Sufjan Stevens is a songwriter who just had his second album out. Pedro the Lion, U2, obviously is a great band. But the thing about these groups is that they're not within the Christian contemporary music machine. And it really is just that, a machine, a big business-backed enterprise that promotes seemingly holy lyrics to an audience that is extremely receptive to it. And the reason why so much modern Christian music sounds so awful is because, unfortunately, many Christian musicians think that the message contained in the song is what's important, not the musical quality. And even if the lyrics weren't theologically vague or false most of the time, that would still be a wrong thing to think. A mediocre song is not holy, is not more holy than a secular song just because it has a moral message.
So is it that they say, okay, I'm going to be singing about my faith, therefore the music can be mediocre, or do you think it's just kind of this cutthroat marketing decision, which is some guy in an office someplace in Nashville says, those Christians will buy anything as long as Jesus gets mentioned once or twice on the CD.
Yeah, definitely there is a problem that Christians seem to reward mediocre musical talent. But I think that there are two endemic problems. One is based in the history of Christian contemporary music. At the start of that movement, the idea was to take popular music and popular trends and wrap them with Jesus lyrics and thereby reach out into the secular world. That obviously has failed miserably because only Christians listen to Christian music. The other problem, though, is this idea that it's really noble to leave the secular world and hide away in this other enclave and not engage in the culture. And this is a very ancient problem. At the time of the Reformation, the Roman Catholic Church was teaching its adherents that it was noble and holy to become a monk or a nun or a priest. And much more noble as compared to being a student or a farmer or a shopkeeper. Luther, at that time, said that was completely wrong, that we serve God and our neighbors by doing our work and hobbies to the best of our abilities. And so Christian musicians should make music that is to the best of their abilities, not copy other people.
Well, we talked some years back with Dr. Gene Edward Veith of World Magazine, who had written a book called Honky Tonk Gospel, I believe, where he's talking about kind of the nexus between gospel and country music. And he makes the case that some people who are just doing good country music are really fulfilling their Christian vocations better than those who are making lousy Christian music.
And I would say he's completely right. And that's why Christian consumers should not have this false idea that they are somehow better by only shopping from the Christian rack of the music aisle.
I think also they feel like they're doing kind of the church's work or the Lord's work when they plunk down $24.99 for a brand new CD that's contemporary Christian music. Where does the money really go, as far as you can tell, Molly?
Well, just, I mean, it's the same as any other genre of music. It's really profitable, and a lot of big businesses are making a lot of money. Of course, the artist is always the last to be paid, but it's a business just like any other, and so it should be judged as such.
Do you think the business machine aspect of contemporary Christian music explains why the message has become even more mediocre than the music sometimes?
I think a lot of people would like to believe that. I really think that the poor quality of the music is really just in response to what consumers want, and Christian consumers, instead of demanding excellent music, are completely fine with Switchfoot and a bunch of other bands that are just almost unbearable to listen to.
Now, let's talk about the imitative quality of contemporary Christian music, where you said before there are trends in music that sell, and the old model was, okay, if that's what's selling, that's what we're just going to wrap our Jesus lyrics around, this kind of music. What does it say that Christian artists are imitating the culture's art?
I think it's just a fascinating indictment of what's happening in the modern world. There's actually a good example of the opposite of this. On the new Coldplay album, there's a song called A Message, which is a really great song, that is a complete ripoff of that Samuel Crossman hymn, My Song is Love Unknown, which is just a very beautiful hymn to listen to. And what you have there is a great example of how the church and Christians used to be at the forefront of popular culture, making really beautiful music, writing great poetry, writing great books that inspired the world, that reached out to the world. Now we have the complete opposite. We take a Britney Spears song and change the lyrics and think that somehow we're doing the Lord's work. And it's just a sad statement. And it's also representative of a larger trend within the Christian culture here in America. I mean, if there's one thing that Christians ever did great musically, it's writing amazing hymns. What's the one thing that people are throwing out left and right of their Sunday worship services? Our hymns. And they're replacing it with just horrible music that they think is so contemporary, when to me it sounds like straight out of the 60s. And they're getting rid of what is one of our greatest pieces of heritage.
Folks, let's hear from you on contemporary Christian music. Do you agree or disagree with Molly Ziegler's assessment of the music as music and as message? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, as usual, issuesetc@kfuo.org. So what would it look like, Molly, if some artist with genuine talent said, look, we don't have to imitate what's selling. We can actually create original art that has a solid message and is musically solid as well.
I think it would look a lot like the band U2, which has been making really amazing lyrics with overtly Christian themes for 20 years. And no one would accuse them of being in the Christian contemporary music realm. But that is a great example of a band that met at a Christian school and proceeded to just make some of the most amazing music that the world has ever seen. And with Bono as their main songwriter, he includes Christian themes in many songs, not, you know, the least of which is evidenced in this last album with a song, Miracle Drug, that quotes from Scripture and has biblical themes in it. You don't need to bat people over the head with these pious, holy-sounding lyrics to share Christian themes.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's start with Ann, who calls from her car. Ann, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was just curious what your guest thinks about the band Newsboys.
Thank you very much, Ann.
You know, I haven't listened to a lot of Newsboys, but I actually think that musically they're doing some pretty adventurous stuff, some pretty original stuff. But I haven't looked too much into them, so I'm sorry I can't comment more.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Talking with Molly Ziegler about contemporary Christian music, and Kathy is on the line from her car. Kathy, welcome.
Yes. I really enjoy both of them. We have the hymns and we have the contemporary. As long as it sticks with the cross, the blood of Jesus, the fact that he's our King and Savior, those kind of things, I look to those kind of lyrics more than anything. But I like them both, and I think they both have a special place. And the Lord gives us new songs, and he gives us hymns, and he gives us psalms.
All right, Kathy, thank you very much, and I'm glad she has that criteria for her message. Molly, what's your response?
I think it's certainly true. I mean, no one's saying that in order for a hymn to be good, it has to be written, you know, before the 1700s, although I might comment that almost every hymn written in the 1800s was pretty bad. But certainly there are new hymns being written every day that are really amazing and should be incorporated into worship. There is something a little bit, and also there's no command in Scripture for a certain style of music that should be included in worship. But there is something dangerous about contemporary worship and praise songs in that it really focuses the congregant on the here and now, the trendy, the temporal, when they should be transported at that time to higher things and the eternal and the unchangeable God.
The other concern I have about that has really nothing to do, well, it actually has everything to do with style. The style in which it is brought into the church, and that is, am I at a concert where I'm expected to watch this guy sing and sing along with my lighter over my head? Or am I expected to sing this? Am I a part of this thing? This big question about performance or worship.
Right, and it does, that's the other problem with contemporary worship being brought into the churches, is that it tends to focus so much on the individual who's singing the songs. There's a solo, or the band members who are placed, you know, at the altar or near the altar. And that's why everybody should be really concerned at their own church to make sure that the music is an aid to focusing on the higher things and not an end unto itself.
Don calls from Junction City, Kansas, and he's listening on the Internet. Don, welcome to Issues Etc.
I was going to tell Molly I appreciate her being on the show, and I agree with her 100%. I hear this loud, blaring music all week long, and I do not want to go to church and hear some more of it. We need the traditional hymns and hymns that give glory to Christ and not the type that centers on man and noise.
Thank
Have
you.
A nice day.
Thank you, Don. Your response, Molly, does mediocre music get any better if you just turn it up louder?
Gets much worse that way, I think.
Dorothy is listening in Alton. Dorothy, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
I agree with Molly, too. I don't care much for contemporary music because it doesn't speak to my heart like the old hymns do. And I know there are some newer hymns being written that are excellent, but I think sometimes, fortunately, our church doesn't do this. We have some of each, but I don't like the contemporary stuff. But most churches tend to leave out the spiritual part of it, and they get up and they have what I call a performance. And we visited a church once where they had 5 or 6 guitars, a band, amplifiers, and I don't know what all, and they sang this same phrase over and over and over and over, and then they took a 10-minute intermission, and they came back and did it some more, and then the preacher gave his message.
Dorothy, thank you very much. Molly?
Well, one thing that I find interesting about when people bring this contemporary worship in, obviously we've already talked about how it's fairly mediocre, but it's brought in usually under the guise people will be told that they would be able to reach out to a larger community if they could just bring this style of worship into their congregation. And it's really not true. I mean, even if it were true, that probably wouldn't be the best justification for it. But study after study shows that, especially with the younger generation, we're barraged with a highly electronic, fast-paced, you know, images all the time and fast music and whatnot, that they look for a retreat in their worship. And when you're aping that which people are trying to flee from, you don't really give them much reason to find sanctuary.
Well, you mentioned the young people. It does, however, attract the boomers.
Yeah, and I love baby boomers. I have two parents who are baby boomers, and they really do. I think that's probably why the music always sounds like it's from the 1960s. And, you know, two baby boomers, it might sound contemporary to them, but it certainly doesn't sound contemporary to people of my generation.
My daughter is 13, so she's in that millennial generation. I don't even know what to call them, XYZs or whatever. Millennial. And she is as eclectic in her taste in music as you could possibly be. And that strikes another thing. There is kind of a vanilla and very middle-of-the-road quality, even to the most, quote-unquote, edgy Christian music out there in the Christian music industry. It all does kind of stay within a very narrow genre. Could Christians do well to think about some other genres for the message if they're going to try and say, hey, let's create great art? The kind of great art that, you know, you got Ray Charles and Elvis and those kind of things who run the whole gamut of what music is and can be.
Again, I think it just comes back to a better understanding of vocation. If you are blessed with musical interests and abilities, make the best music that you're inspired to make. I mean, our faith is so inspiring and so creative, and our music should represent that, and not copy what's happening in the world. And earlier you were asking about the industry and whether it contributes to the mediocrity of the music. And I do think that when you're trying to push a big, if you're trying to push an artist and make the most money, you might encourage them not to be as specific when they're using the Jesus word, or that's why the lyrics get dumbed down. But also musically, they know that unfortunately, they might sell more if they are more accessible rather than innovative and adventurous.
So if there's no profit in it, I mean, artists do typically starve, right? The best ones.
Well,
if there's no profit in it, then speak to the Christian artist who has talents in the music and encourage them that this vocation is one that Christians too ought to have, even if it doesn't fill up a stadium or sell a bunch of CDs.
Right. The Christian idea is never about worldly success, and so whether or not we make a lot of money or have the world love us should never be our ultimate goal. It should be about using the gifts that God has given us to best do what we can do. And if that's music, then there's a world of music out there waiting to be discovered and rediscovered. And if you're a budding Christian musician, the world is waiting for you to create amazing music that challenges and inspires the world.
Well, to round this off, Molly, here's my experience from my contemporary Christian music days, which was junior high and high school, playing in one of the original LCMS praise bands, in one of the original LCMS church growth congregations down in Carrollton, Texas, near Dallas. I was not a good guitar player, and not really that great of a singer either. But I was let in because I was a devout little pious Christian boy. Yes, I did have hair in those days, although I probably would have attracted more attention without it. I'll be honest with you, Molly, I got in it because of a girl, but they let me in the group because, well, you know, he can manage his way through five or six chords, and he doesn't sing off-key all the time. Is that kind of the logic that operates sometimes in contemporary Christian music? Which is, hey, they're a Christian, so they don't have to be that talented. I would have made a better roadie, I think.
Yeah, obviously many contemporary Christian songwriters and musicians seem to think that they can overcome their musical shortcomings by just relying on pious Christians to do the music or slapping an I Heart Jesus sticker on the top of it. And unfortunately, the contemporary Christian music industry has figured out that there is a world of Christians out there seeking to avoid evil lyrics and some of the more negative cultural aspects of secular music that will purchase Christian tunes no matter what. And you know, can you imagine a secular band taking someone on just because he was a nice guy? No, of course not. I mean, in this regard, secular musicians have their priorities more straight than we do. If you want to make really good music, you should have the best musicians making that music.
And speak then, finally, to the Christian consumers who, if you could, dissuade them of the notion that they have to buy it because everything else is morally worse, but maybe musically better.
Well, I still while listeners should discern what is valuable to listen to and what lyrics are worthwhile and which songs are beneficial, Christians need to stop thinking that they're more holy by buying Christian music. Musical gifts are bestowed on the just and the unjust, just like the rain that God sends. And Christians would no more buy a car based on how many Christians work at the plant than any other consumer decisions they make. But somehow, when it comes to music, they don't listen to what's great out there because they think that it's more important if the songwriter is Christian. Just a completely wrong idea. It's completely pious, and the Reformation answered this question 500 years ago, and so we've had more than enough time to incorporate it into our own Christianity.
Folks, as we approach a new school year, I cannot think of a better way, something to send your kid off to college or high school or junior high with, than Higher Things magazine. It is for high school and college age kids, for your grandkids as well. For more information on Higher Things magazine, go to their website, higherthings.org, higherthings.org. Molly Ziegler is a freelance writer in Washington, D.C., and author of an article in the latest Higher Things magazine titled Contemporary Christian Music, Majestic or Merely Mediocre. Molly, it's always a pleasure, and thanks for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
When we come back from this break, we're going to be spending the second hour with Dr. Reed Lessing here in Studio A. We have talked about Christ in the Song of Songs. There are some real challenges in this conversation we've been having through the summer on Christ in the Old Testament. Last time we talked with Dr. Andy Bartelt about Christ in the book of Isaiah. We stay in the Old Testament, of course, and go to a different prophet, but a prophet different from Isaiah. Isaiah has a lot to say about what's going on around him. Ezekiel talks a lot about what's going on, well, in heaven and in the visions that God gives him in his head. So we're going to be finding Christ in the book of Ezekiel when we come back from this break with Dr. Reed Lessing of Concordia Seminary. Then in the third hour of the program, Jennifer Roback Morse joins us. She is a research fellow at the Hoover Institute. We're going to be talking with her about smart sex, about consumer sex, about the state of the sexual revolution. You know, the ideas of the sexual revolution were at the time completely radical. Now they are completely mainstream. What were the promises of the sexual revolution, and have those promises been kept? We'll talk about that in the third hour of Issues, Etc. coming up in about 60 minutes. Jennifer Roback Morse will be our guest. In the meantime, we'll spend an hour with Dr. Reed Lessing on Christ in Ezekiel. Get your Bibles open to the Old Testament right there in the middle. You'll find Ezekiel the prophet. We'll jump in and find Christ there right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.